Americans spent more at the stores last month.
So does that mean the recovery can restart?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org, and it's Tuesday, September 14th. Retail sales make a comeback. Republicans say no deal on tax cuts. And if Barack Obama had a statue at President's Park, it'd be angry that the place is closing. That's later. But first,
this morning, the government said retail sales rose in August, second consecutive month. So let's talk about it with our Tuesday morning regular analyst, Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Bill.
So retail sales up a little more than expected in August. How good a sign is that?
Well, it's really nothing to cheer about because analysts were lowballing estimates anyway, and they came in a little bit better than they expected. Bottom line is Americans are not becoming spendthrifts again. Retailers are managing their inventories, and everybody's purchasing cautiously.
Well, somebody's buying something. Who's buying?
Well, at Best Buy, for example, everybody's pushing the connections and the content, not just the iPhone. People are buying services. At the grocers, Kroger figured you'd make more money off of house brands, and they're selling those house brands. The rich are back at Nordstrom's, Bloomie's, Saks. The wannabes aren't back. They're buying it at outlets. The middle income, JCPenney, Sears, that's layaway and value spending. And specialty, well, it depends on what the specialty is. Auto parts, gangbusters, home furnishings. The real estate industry is still in a bust mode.
You mentioned people with incomes. The Senate Republican leader is saying make the Bush tax cuts permanent. The economy needs it. Is that just politics, Julie, or would more tax cuts, even for top earners, really help put people to work?
Well, bottom line is the politicians are saying we're afraid of these big, huge tax deficits here, but not at your expense, dear voters. So they're trying to have it both ways. Bottom line is, though, the rich make the campaign contributions, but the middle class votes. Now, under the Bush tax cuts, the rich saw almost a 6% increase in disposable income. The middle Americans, about 2.5% in disposable income. So I think they're going to move toward the package that goes toward middle America because they vote. And we're still the lowest tax rate in a developed country in the world.
Okay. Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company. Good to talk to you. Thank you.
You bet.
The tax cuts proposed by then-President Bush and passed by a Republican Congress a few years back are set to expire at the end of this year. Now, Bush's successor, President Obama, wants only the tax cuts for households making less than $250,000 renewed. And House Minority Leader John Boehner said he would go along with that, or could go along with that as a last resort. But now the GOP leader in the Senate says that's not going to happen. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is with us from Washington with the latest. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
So what happened to this possible compromise?
Well, Senate Republicans say they won't compromise. The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, has introduced legislation that would keep the tax cuts in place for everyone indefinitely, and that includes the richest Americans. McConnell says no one should get a tax hike in this economy, and he says some Democrats agree with him.
There's a growing chorus of Democrats, including at least five right here in the Senate, are coming around on this issue.
So, Nancy, does Senator McConnell have enough support to pull this off?
Well, that's not clear right now, Steve. McConnell could filibuster, and he would need all 41 Republicans in the Senate to go along with that, and there's no indication that they will. Plus, time is running out before the November elections, and remember, these tax cuts do expire at the end of the year. Now, President Obama is trying to convince Congress to keep the tax cuts for only middle-class taxpayers and let them expire for the richest Americans. He says that's only about 3% of the population, and he says if their tax cuts do expire, the federal government would take in another $700 billion in revenue that could be used to pare down the deficit.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reporting live from Washington. Nancy, thanks.
You're welcome.
The U.S. Senate starts work this week on a measure to support small businesses, and a test vote comes today. Republicans want to roll back a new rule that makes a business owner's tax return more complicated. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
The new rules are designed to catch tax cheats. Businesses will have to file 1099 forms for everything they buy over $600, office supplies, software, you name it. That has groups like the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council barking mad. Member Barbara Werner was at her Virginia home and garden store when I called.
The blessings of a small business is that I have my dogs with me. Get over here. Come on.
Werner is facing a mountain of new paperwork for the IRS.
1,000 1099s for the businesses that I purchase from, It would be staggering.
CPA Cap Willey of the National Small Business Association says his group backs a Republican amendment to repeal the provision. Then the Senate bill should be passed to cut business taxes and get credit flowing again.
Small business lending has pretty much dried up, so it's going to be a critical aspect to get the SBA back in gear.
The bill would restore money for SBA loans and provide up to $30 billion to community banks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, September 14th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective right now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. Cuba says it's eliminating 500,000 state workers over the next year. In return, the government says it's going to allow some people to become self-employed on the island or even try and spur hiring at private firms. The communist government currently employs about 95% of the Cuban workforce. George Montalvan is an international economic consultant, an expert on the Cuban economy, and he's with us live from Washington, D.C. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So why now? Why is Cuba making these layoffs right now?
Well, the Cuban economy is in the midst of a very severe economic and leadership crisis, maybe the worst in the revolution's 50 years. The idea, and you mentioned this, that the government could be the only employer is unworkable anywhere, including Cuba, but especially now when there is an extreme acute budget crisis and it can't continue to keep 5.1 million workers, virtually the entire labor force, on the payroll. The other thing is that productivity has plummeted in recent years because thousands of young people have been emigrating, many to the U.S., for many years, and there are strong disincentives to work hard for those who remain.
Was this Cuba's only option for saving the economy there? Were there other plans, perhaps?
Well, they need to do much, much more in order to survive this crisis, which also comes at a time when the leadership is fading, as we all know, due to old age. Eventually, the system will have to be dismantled.
The communist system.
Yes, the socialist, communist, totalitarian system will have to be dismantled. Much is made of the U.S. embargo on Cuba, but a far more severe embargo is the one placed by the Cuban government on its own citizens by not allowing them to establish businesses and invest, among other things.
You know, layoffs are obviously bad for the economy, but can anything positive in about 20 seconds, can anything positive come out of this?
The Cuban economy is too small and cannot absorb 500,000 self-employed workers. The layoffs will only be positive if those laid off are allowed to establish small businesses and cooperatives, hire other Cubans, and as I said before, invest, et cetera. They will require capital, and this will be a major challenge to overcome.
It's a tall order. George Montalvan joining us from Washington. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Joblessness could pose the next big threat to the global economic recovery. The head of the International Monetary Fund said long-term unemployment could even lead to massive social unrest. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is live with us from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
How bad is the global unemployment situation? We just heard about Cuba, right?
Yeah, well, the latest figures put unemployment at its highest in history. Officially, 210 million are out of work worldwide, 34 million of them as a result of the crisis. And long-term unemployment's getting worse. In the U.S., half the unemployed have been out of work for over 6 months, something we haven't seen since the Great Depression. As you say, the head of the IMF says this could easily lead to serious social unrest.
And what is the head of the IMF proposing as a remedy?
Well, he says very clearly what governments should not do. He says they should not cut public spending drastically. He says that will only make matters worse. And this is a direct rebuke to U.S. Republicans who are calling for cuts and to the British government, which is actually planning major cuts. And this coincides with a warning here from a British police chief that the police may not be able to cope with the likely unrest in Britain. Mind you, the skeptics say there's a certain amount of special pleading here. The police could well themselves be one of the targets of the British cuts, and they want to warn the UK government that whatever they cut, the police must remain unscathed.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
The World Economic Forum is meeting in China. At its opening ceremony, China's premier Wen Jiabao admitted that some of Chinese policies have been making it hard for foreign businesses in China. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has more.
It wasn't an apology, but Premier Wen's rare admission of guilt was exactly what foreign investors in China wanted to hear.
I thought it was very encouraging and consistent with what he's been saying recently.
Christian Merck is president of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. Lately, his group has been on the offensive against China, criticizing the country for making life more difficult for foreign businesses. One Chinese policy in his crosshairs gives preferential treatment to Chinese technology over foreign technology for government contracts. Merck hopes Wen's comments signal change.
A more active and serious dialogue is certainly in progress, but I haven't seen any major change in behavior yet.
Other foreign investors haven't seen it yet either. Most of them agree whether it's shutting foreign companies out of government contracts or blatantly pirating foreign technology, China can still be a tricky place to do business. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We told you about retail sales a little while ago. That includes a lot of clothes buying. And some clothing could get a little more expensive thanks to a rise in the price of cotton. Droughts and floods have wiped out a lot of the cotton harvest in China and Pakistan. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
A shortage in the world's cotton supply has come at a pretty rotten time for retailers. Having limped through the recession, they're now facing the highest cotton prices for 15 years. And three major UK clothing stores have already said they're likely to pass on the cost to consumers rather than let their profit margin take the hit. Neil Saunders is from retail analysts Verdict Research. He says US consumers should prepare for the same.
The whole supply chain in clothing is so interconnected and so global now that even if the US has a relatively good crop of cotton, of course a lot of clothing is still imported from China. There's too much demand for cotton at the moment and there isn't enough supply.
Cotton's not the only cost increase retailers are facing. Global shipping and energy bills are higher too. And after 10 years of falling prices for consumers, Saunders reckons we've reached the bottom. So bargain hunters should grab that $3 T-shirt because prices are unlikely to get much lower. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, September 14th. I'm Bill Radke. When you want to know what's going on with the markets, just go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Airplanes, we know, are big polluters. How to regulate that pollution is a worldwide conundrum. The United Nations is about to consider a global standard for airline carbon emissions. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports American trade groups are pushing for a standard that is less tough than the one coming out of Europe.
Unlike, say, a bricks-and-mortar factory, airplanes pollute while circling the globe. Steve Lott is with the International Air Transport Association. He says that's why it's best to regulate planes globally. Regional systems would just compound penalties.
You could have one flight going from the U.S. to London to Sydney, and that one flight would be taxed three times for a single amount of emissions.
But efforts to set a global standard have taxied on the runway for more than a decade. So the European Union took off with its own system. By 2012, any airline landing at an EU airport will pay for emissions over a certain limit. Lott says that could cost airlines up to $3 billion a year. So
it would be less costly to avoid Europe and travel through another international hub to get to their destination.
Lott says the U.S. is determined not to let Europe set the standards for the world. But EU officials say emission standards have to start somewhere. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The final season of Oprah Winfrey's television talk show premiered this week. Once it ends, the show will leave a huge gap in the local economy of Chicago, a place that's been home to many popular talk shows. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
If there are ever plans for a TV talk show Hall of Fame, Chicago would be the perfect location. For decades, the Windy City's been home to a variety of personalities who brought their own twist to the Gabfest format. Of course, there's Oprah with her emotional and more personal take.
Well, we're going to talk to Elliot's mom and dad when we come back.
But there's also been Jerry Springer, who went for more of the absurd.
Would you sleep with your mother?
I don't know. It depends.
Robert Feeder is a media reporter and blogger. He says Chicago's talk show history goes back to the 1940s.
There was something called the Chicago School of Television, which referred to a low-budget, very personal, one-on-one style of making television.
Dave Garraway, the first host of the Today Show, got his start here. Studs Terkel used a Chicago diner as the setting for his talk show.
This is Studs' place. Any minute, there will be a story happening here.
Chicago historian Tim Samuelson says that think-on-your-feet style led to Phil Donahue, who acted more as a newsman in front of a live audience and dominated the ratings until Oprah came along.
This was very much in the Chicago television tradition.
Chicago talk peaked in the 90s when Oprah and Springer fought for viewers along with Jenny Jones, whose show included themes like Too Buff to Date. But one by one, Chicago's talk show landscape has become a ghost town. Oprah ends her show in May, and Jerry Springer recently moved his show to Connecticut. Media reporter Robert Feeder.
The fact is that the city and the state of Illinois have not stepped up to the extent that other places have in providing the kind of financial incentives and tax breaks that have enticed much of the production elsewhere.
Feeder says Chicago should fear not, though. He says some other syndicated talk shows are in the works to be filmed in the city, including one from Howard Stern called Bubba the Love Sponge. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
India's tea trade has really not changed a lot in 150 years since British colonials began cultivating it there. But there is a movement now to make the industry more sustainable for the people who make the tea and the land that provides the leaves. Reporter Raymond Thibodeau has more from Darjeeling in the Indian state of West Bengal.
Workers pluck fresh shoots off tea bushes in the morning mist of Darjeeling. This is the capital of India's tea industry, but the small-scale farmers and laborers rank among India's poorest, so now they're trying to earn a better living by producing their own organic tea. Some 300 of them have formed a cooperative called Organic Ekta. Its organic, fair trade tea brings higher prices from buyers, says co-op member Bandana Rai. Bandana says she's more than tripled her income. She used the extra money to build a new kitchen and enroll her two sons in better schools. Organic Ekta was launched about 3 years ago with the help of Portland-based NGO Mercy Corps and Tazo, the tea arm of Starbucks.
It has given new hope for now and for the future.
Raja Banerjee is a fourth-generation tea estate owner. He's one of Organic Ekta's main buyers. He says Darjeeling's $1.5 billion a year tea industry has been in decline for years, and that Organic Ekta and other similar tea cooperatives are a good thing. He's already started offering shares of his Makabari tea estates to his employees, essentially making them partners.
To get people to be self-respecting grassroots entrepreneurs is the only way out. And if it's your own cow, you know how best to milk it.
Still, some analysts question whether cooperatives such as Organic Ekta can survive without backers such as Tazo and Mercy Corps. Bigger tea estate owners say organic teas have much smaller yields and are expensive to produce. But Ruben Prabhan, a Mercy Corps director in Darjeeling, disagrees.
The tea industry needed a reform. We all believe in Organic Ekta that this is the change that the Darjeeling tea industry needed, and this could be the future of Darjeeling tea.
Prabhan says one day tea associations could own their own factories to process and package their teas and make even better profits from the tea headed for the shelves of a supermarket near you. In Darjeeling, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
And finally, Yorktown, Virginia, is where the British General Cornwallis surrendered to George Washington. And it's where President's Park has surrendered to the recession.
Yes, President's Park is this spot where visitors can walk among 18-foot-tall busts of every American president, except Barack Obama. The park's owner says he was trying to raise the $60,000 for the Obama statue, but the fundraising fell short, and now the park must close. All the giant heads must go. They got to be sold. I would love to know who the buyer will be.
Mount Rushmore, maybe?
Good. It'll sort of make those little heads look, so make them look tiny, a little cluster.
Fit right in over there, wouldn't it?
You can see photos of the real President's Park at our website. Go see it before it's gone, marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.